The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, with you today on May 9th, 2004. I want to let you know that this is a pre-recorded show. We did it a few days before going on air, so please don't call in today. Just sit back and relax and listen to my guest speak with me, and we'll have a conversation about media today. Our guest today is Jeff Cohen, founder of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting back in 1986. He served as that group's executive director for a number of years and later on its board of directors. We've had many people connected with FAIR on Media Matters over the years, but we've never had Jeff before, so it's a pleasure to have him. More recently, Jeff Cohen has been a producer at MSNBC, a senior producer in The Donahue Show, and he was an on-air commentator on the Fox News Channel's News Watch, and at one time served as a co-host on CNN's Crossfire. Jeff's written several books, including Wizards of Media Oz, Through the Media Looking Glass, The Way Things Aren't, and Adventures in Media Land. Those books, I believe, are some of them are written with Norman Solomon, also a frequent guest here on Media Matters. Jeff Cohen, welcome to Media Matters.
Great to be with you.
It's really terrific to have you on the air. I should let, as a matter of editorial openness, acknowledge that Jeff Cohen's a friend of mine and has also been editor of my most recent book, Line Editing It, and did a terrific job, and I'm in his debt for that. But I met you first, Jeff, or first saw you. I don't know if you remember this. I think I've told you this story. In 1986, the year you founded FAIR, you came to Seattle where I was then a grad student,
right.
And you gave sort of a warm-up talk for Alexander Coburn.
Right.
And it was a brilliant talk. It was right when the group that ABC was doing a TV movie. I think it was ABC. One
yes.
of the networks is doing
yes.
this TV movie called America with three Ks or something. Or,
right.
And it was like about a prospective like takeover of the United States by the Russians and the United Nations working with the Russians.
Right.
And okay. Talk a little bit about.
Yeah, that was a fun era. Now remember, I started FAIR in 1986, and when you start a nonprofit at the national level, you're trying to figure out what can you do to immediately get noticed. Well, thankfully, our problem was solved for us by ABC, as you pointed out. They. In this era of right-wing movies, paranoid fantasies about the communists taking over America, or about brave heroes like Rambo killing thousands of communists in a weekend, there was a huge, and it went along with the Reagan right-wing agenda and evil empire kind of aggressive international talk. The mainstream media, including parts of Hollywood, were sort of rallying to this right-wing paranoid vision. And there were movies like Red Dawn, movies like Rambo, and then ABC decided they were going to do a 14-hour miniseries that graphically depicted, day after day, hour after hour, a joint Soviet-United Nations takeover of America and a clampdown on freedom. And I remember I was quoted in all the major press as saying, this is ABC's 14-hour commercial for Star Wars. Now, it was never for the Star Wars missile defense. It was never clear how the Soviets and the United Nations took us over, but it involved something, that Star Wars might have defended us against. And it was like a right-wing wet dream. So you must have seen me in Seattle. FAIR got a copy of the script for this crazed, paranoid, right-wing fantasy that ABC was doing for 14 hours. And with that script, we were able to show all sorts of things about the upcoming show. We leaked it to newspapers and magazines. We built a movement questioning the role that Hollywood and television was playing in whipping up Cold War hysteria. Remember, this is 1986 when the Soviet Union is falling apart.
Yeah.
And so you had all of these television networks and movie studios going to town with Reagan creating this specter of an all-powerful Soviet Union with their UN collaborators going to take over our country, and that's what put FAIR on the map.
Now, I like to joke that when FAIR started, it was one or two people working out of a closet in Manhattan,
right.
And today it's six people working out of a closet in Manhattan.
Actually, we have some resources now, but the staff is still small, but very well equipped.
And we
used to fight over the one phone back in 1986.
Yeah, but I mean, just for the sake of our listeners unfamiliar with FAIR, the website is www.fair.org. And FAIR is known, I think, to a lot of our listeners through the radio show Counterspin, which airs both on WILL and on WEFT locally, and also by its bi-monthly publication, Extra, which has been published now for since the late 80s. Isn't that right?
Right. It started in 1987. I would say if America with a K, that was the name of the 14-hour miniseries, if that first put us on the map, the second thing that put FAIR on the map is when we got two academics to study the guest list of ABC's Nightline program. And no show has ever been studied as thoroughly as that particular study, which was done in the late 80s by Bill Hoynes and David Kratto. They studied 40 months, 845 shows, which was 2,498 guests. You get a very good picture of who gets on the air and who doesn't get on the air when you do a survey of that magnitude. And we learned that the four most frequent guests were Henry Kissinger, the former Secretary of State, former Secretary of State Alexander Haig, former Assistant Secretary of State Elliot Abrams, and Jerry Falwell. Falwell was asked to give his expertise on one show about AIDS and on another show about homosexuals. So, you know, we were able to show in a survey of Nightline just the center-right elites spectrum that dominated TV and how few minorities got on the air, how few women got on the air, how few representatives of labor, environmental, or consumer groups got on the air. And that was, I'd say, the second big thing that put FAIR on the map was first the America campaign against Cold War hysteria in the media, and then the Nightline campaign showing the narrow corporate elite nature of who's allowed to speak on our dominant medium, television, and who isn't.
And I think that is the hallmark of Extra and FAIR's work to this day, doing serious and hardcore empirical analytical examinations, who the sources are for news, what topics are covered, and what's not covered, who's not getting to be a source for the news. Amy Goodman was on our show just a few weeks ago, and she talked about the FAIR survey done surrounding Colin Powell's speech to the United Nations in 2003 that really was the main speech that sort of was justification for the U.S. invasion. And the week or so before and after, or immediately after the Powell speech, on all the major news programs, there were something like 400 sources, and only three of them were critical of Powell or critical of the war effort.
Right. And how different is that than what would happen when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan? I mean, there it would be 400-0. In our country, it's like 390-3. I mean, that's not a real debate. That's not anything that approaches a semblance of freedom of speech or freedom of press, but that's what passes for debate. And, I, you know, when you look at the role that the media played in the buildup to the war, and I was in television and network TV at the time, it's truly appalling. And as Amy Goodman says, I agree with it completely, it may be the lowest point for U.S. mainstream media in history, and that's saying something.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Jeff Cohen, the founder of Fairness in Action Reporting, more recently a producer on The Donahue Show and one of the panelists on Fox News Channel's News Watch. Jeff is speaking to us on the phone from his home in Woodstock, New York. And Jeff, this is a pre-tape show. It has to be pre-taped, that's obvious. It's a tape show done shortly before going on air, so please don't try to call in today. Just sit back and enjoy the show. And Jeff, let's talk a little bit about press coverage on major issues, because I know you are, in my view, one of the really sharp media analysts, press critics. And I regret to say, and I think your comments suggest this as well, that in the last 18 years, FAIR has more work now cut out for us than it did then. It's not like the situation's improving very much.
No, it certainly isn't. The you know, FAIR was set up in part, one of our missions was to try to stop the consolidation of media. Clearly that's been a miserable failure. You know, when FAIR was formed in 86 was the beginning of the three TV networks had all undergone ownership changes in the mid-80s. There was also the head of the FCC, Mr. Fowler, for Ronald Reagan, was making comments like, television set is no much more than a toaster with pictures. Why would we regulate the toaster industry? So why should we regulate this? And it was the beginning of consolidation, and that was one of FAIR's goals, and I must admit that's been a complete failure. Another goal had been to try to diversify what we showed as a very narrow center-right elite guest list. That hasn't really improved. But our third goal, I think we really have accomplished something. The third goal was to organize constituencies and talk to mass constituencies of millions of people about what tools they have to see through media bias, to understand media bias, to talk back to media bias, and to organize politically around the media. And I would say in that third of three goals, FAIR and its allies, including groups like yours, Bob, Free Press and others, we really succeeded in that third goal. There's a big media reform movement now that didn't exist in 1986. There's so many millions of people that are conscious of media bias, that consciously seek out alternative websites and non-corporate publications because of the work that FAIR and other groups have done. So in the arena of building a movement of skeptical news consumers and active media consumers and people that talk back to the media and are organizing politically to try to diversify and democratize our media system, there have been great gains there, especially as exemplified by the upsurge, the rebellion of 2003 against the FCC's efforts to, you know, take away what few rules there were protecting diversity and preventing complete media monopolization. There was a big upsurge in 2003, and I think that's one thing that FAIR can point to. Well, we played a little role in contributing to that.
Jeff Cohen, our guest today on Media Matters. Jeff, on this show we talk a lot about the press coverage of the war. You've already alluded to it in your comments, the war in Iraq, the buildup and the occupation. But another subject that's of great importance for media is how it covers candidates and elections,
right,
how it gives voters and citizens an opportunity to evaluate candidates so they can make wise choices or informed choices for who's going to run, who's going to be in the position of power in government. And you have worked closely on studying these issues and participating in the political process. What's your sense of media coverage of the 2004 presidential campaign?
Well, it's I started in 2003, where I was an active participant. I was the communications director for a few months with Dennis Kucinich for president. And that brought me to the debates. It brought me into interaction with all the leading political writers who were covering the campaign. I was able to meet the candidates. So I got a real close-in look, closer than most media critics would get to the process.
Mm-hmm.
And although I was not naive about media bias, I must say that my months with Kucinich were some of the most depressing in terms of how an elite group of journalists operating as a little club, a little clique, a little herd, how they could have so much power to shape and suppress and mold the news. I was in room after room in the early primaries, before the primaries, in the early part of the Democratic nomination fight. I'd be in room after room with peace activists or labor activists or Democratic Party activists, where all 9 or 10 of the candidates would speak. And because the political big feet, these are the top 10 reporters whose coverage so influences each other and so influences the process. Adam Nagorny, the New York Times chief political writer, Dan Baltz, the Washington Post chief political writer, Joe Klein, Ronald Brownstein from the LA Times. I'd be in room after room where Dennis Kucinich, the congressman of Ohio, would get 10 standing ovations. Howard Dean would get one standing ovation. People like Graham, Lieberman, Kerry, they'd get like polite applause. And I'd read the newspapers the next day to see if whether these reporters had accurately reflected what happened in the room. Because if you're a day-to-day reporter, you're supposed to tell people what happened yesterday. And I would look at their coverage, and these reporters were so blinded by their preconceived notions of who's a credible candidate, who's a contender, who's a front runner, that it completely obliterated their ability to report what they saw. So even if it was a room where, and this is, by the way, not contested, that in many of these rooms, Kucinich would get his 10 standing ovations and only Dean would get a standing ovation and at most one or two, you'd read the newspapers the next day, and it's as if they were writing each other's copy, because they tell you what Joe Lieberman said Here's a guy who anyone knew wasn't going to go anywhere in this race. You'd hear what Dean said, what Kerry said, what Bob Graham said, what John Edwards said, quotes from each. And then sometimes you wouldn't even realize that Kucinich had been there. You wouldn't know that Kucinich had been in the room when, in fact, he had won the room. And that was pretty instructive to me because I'm pretty well connected to progressive activists from my history of decades, and I'd go from state to state, Iowa, New Hampshire. I'd run into literally hundreds of people that, in my view, probably reflected thousands and thousands of people who would always say, look, Dennis Kucinich is my candidate, but the mainstream media doesn't cover him, so I'm with Howard Dean. And it was really sort of mind-blowing. It was activists saying that they weren't going to work for the candidate of their choice because they were letting the mainstream media determine who they'd work for, and they were going to only work for a candidate that was getting a fair treatment, so they sort of went to Dean. The irony, and by the way, Dean was saying some very good things during that period, but it would be person after person admitting that Kucinich is their candidate, but they'd be with Dean because Kucinich just doesn't get covered.
Well, why is it, Jeff, you think that Kucinich was not getting covered relative to Edwards and Graham and Lieberman and the other candidates? Here he is, an elected member of Congress, many terms. He's been a mayor of a major city. I mean, it's not like he's just someone who trotted in.
They filtered out the message. It's what Noam Chomsky has written about for decades. His message was too strong. He wasn't just against the war. He was against U.S. foreign policy. He wasn't just mildly critical of trade agreements so he can get labor votes during a primary election. He was saying that his first act in office would be to repeal the World Trade Organization and get the U.S. out of that and get the U.S. out of NAFTA. So, it was a message that was too hot. As Noam Chomsky has said for years, what the media do is they look around for someone who can be an emblem of a movement, but really it doesn't really operate within the heart and soul of that movement. And that's, I think, the role that they gave to Howard Dean, whereas Kucinich was deemed too strong, too powerful, too forceful on all these issues. They would refer to Dean as the strident anti-war advocate. He became what Chomsky called the acceptable dove.
Yeah.
And Dennis Kucinich was deemed outside the acceptable spectrum and therefore not worthy of coverage.
What do you think Dennis Kucinich would have done had he gotten comparable amount of coverage and tone of coverage of, say, Gephardt, Lieberman, Edwards, and that caliber? How do you think it would have affected his performance?
I think he would have been a contender in the Iowa primary, and whoever won Iowa won the whole thing. I think, by the way, I'm not just talking out my ear here. The great reporter Taibbi, who wrote about media coverage of the election for The Nation magazine, was traveling with these reporters. And if you look in The Nation magazine in his report about the other political reporters, he asked some of them. He said, why don't you cover Kucinich? Why do you always focus on horse race? Who's raised the most money? Who's got the most experienced staff from the last Clinton team? When are you going to cover the issues? And a couple of them said, hey, if we covered the election the way you want it covered, Dennis Kucinich could become the nominee. I mean,
heaven forbid.
Yeah. And so I think that there's an understanding that if you give fair treatment to a guy who so speaks to the base of the Democratic Party and brings the base to its feet and repeats standing ovations, that if you were a referee refereeing a fair fight and giving all the candidates fair treatment, then the worst of all possible worlds, Kucinich might have won. But I want to go further, that they in a way helped Dean, but they weren't intending to initially. They were just trying to come up with someone who could play the role of dove, and it had to be an acceptable dove. And in every single speech Dean ever gave, he said while he was against the starting the war in Iraq, he was for the last Gulf War, he was for this intervention and that intervention, he's for staying in Iraq, and he's for keeping the military budget as exactly what it is under Bush. So that made him the forceful anti-war leader, because he was acceptable. He was like sort of the left edge of the elite spectrum. And while a lot of the coverage that was helping Dean and sort of driving Kucinich and driving activists away from Kucinich, I don't think any of that coverage was intended to help Dean. It's just that if he's the only guy who's acknowledged in mainstream media coverage as anti-war and unknown to the political big feet, this elite group of political reporters, the base of the Democratic Party was thoroughly anti-war. It was just helping build the Dean movement. Every time an article would be written about Dean that called him the strident or forceful or unwavering anti-war voice.
No, you're right. I mean, it was routinely presented in the media, and I know you know this better than anyone, that when they'd go through the field of Democratic candidates, it wasn't uncommon to say, well, Howard Dean's the one who's come out firmly against the war.
And as I say, if they're in rooms where Dennis wins, Dean comes in second, and the other candidates barely get polite applause, and then you read about it the next day, and all you hear is Dean is saying this, the other candidates are saying that, and Dennis isn't even acknowledged as being in the room, that really helps. Now, the irony is that by the time we got to the few weeks before Iowa, the media kept, it was like a drumbeat that Dean, nomination of Dean could be a disaster for the party, that he's not as electable, that he doesn't have sufficient national security credentials, that he's too far left, that the electable candidates are Kerry or Edwards. And you saw an unprecedented migration in the polls in a 16-day period away from Dean to these other two candidates who surged. And again, what concerns me is that even liberal activists, even sophisticated people, are, in a sense, letting the mainstream media and the mainstream pundits and the conventional wisdom determine their own choices about who they vote for in Iowa. And while initially some media helped Dean get noticed, and it certainly did, it was a vicious anti-Dean media in the end of November, December, and January that really turned Iowa away from Dean and helped Kerry immensely. And it was a news media that was almost a drumbeat that Howard Dean has a problem. He has a, in the words of Newsweek magazine, which it had an article that was, what was it? Anger Management. No, Times headline, Anger Management 101. Newsweek's headline, All the Rage.
Was this after the famous screen?
No, before. That's the key.
Okay.
That's what people have to understand.
Okay.
That when the media had done a job on Dean and that he's not electable, you know, the one cover in a national news magazine was Destiny or Disaster. You know, there'd be a McGovern-like disaster if Dean were nominated. And then you had all these stories about his alleged temper. Anger Management 101 was in Time Magazine. All the Rage was Newsweek. New York Times headline, As the Race Turns Hot. What about Dean's collar? And the whole idea was, here was a guy who was not steady enough to be president. And keep in mind that we were headed at this during the time of this news coverage, portraying Dean as somehow too unstable to be president. We had a guy in the White House who was saying, you know, was coming off like a macho hothead telling enemy fighters to bring it on, you know. And here the mainstream media felt the need to warn, you know, Joe and Jane Sixpack and Workaday America that this Dean guy may be too unsteady, too angry to be president. It was truly an astounding case study. And the media assault on Dean really hurt him, and they'd already defeated the Dean campaign well before he gave that very animated speech, the so-called I Have a Dream speech. The mainstream media had driven Dean's numbers down so badly in the previous weeks that the Dean campaign was effectively over before I Have a Scream speech, and it had nothing to do with that speech.
Now, some people would argue that whoever the front runner is going to get raked over the coals. That's part of the primary process, to really work over the front runner so they can stand up to a general election attack. Did Kerry, who after Iowa emerged front and center as the favorite and soon the prohibitive favorite, did he get that sort of work over by the media at that time?
Nothing close. It was nothing close. Again, Kerry was the kind of candidate that the political big feet felt according to their own biases, and they'll never say this, but if you look at the correspondence I have with it, even private emails to these guys back and forth, there was a sense that Kucinich was off the spectrum, Dean was not part of the establishment and couldn't be trusted, and yet Kerry's a guy they've known for decades. So I think there's consciously or subconsciously, Kerry was a guy who I think was very acceptable to these people that were writing this horrible coverage about Dean at the end, and the ones who had almost censored Kucinich out of the race.
Now, how's the, since Kerry really sort of locked up the nomination in February.
Right.
And now the attention, once Edwards withdraws from the race, shifts to Kerry versus Bush.
Right.
And what's your sense of the press coverage of the presidential, the general, now that it started, now we are mid-May, but going back to mid-March over the past 2 months?
Well, I think the part of the problem is a typical we saw it against Clinton. There's a right-wing propaganda machine that can float all sorts of stories, whether they're true or not. They start on right-wing websites or right-wing magazines. They get into Fox News and New York Post. Then before you know it, they're on CNN and MSNBC, and these things turn out to be complete hoaxes. We had a story very early, right after Kerry was the nominee. It was clear he was the nominee. We had a story that filtered in that Kerry had his problem with an intern, a young intern. It was huge in the Murdoch press in England, made it onto Fox News, MSNBC, and there's probably millions of people who heard the story, and there was absolutely no truth to it. Then you had the concocted photograph that put Jane Fonda, who's dreaded by some and some Vietnam vets and not others, but some, a concocted photograph where Kerry and Jane Fonda are put together, and that got everywhere, even in the New York Times before they discovered it was a hoax. You know, they were referring to this photograph. I fear that because there's a ideological right-wing media with so much power, it's part of the mainstream media, and then that's Fox News, Wall Street Journal editorial page, New York Post, et cetera. And then you have the corporate centrists that are completely intimidated by the right wing and worried that Fox News might say something about them. And you have an ideological left-wing media, but nothing that you could call mainstream. And because of that typical lopsidedness, where the spectrum goes from the far right that would do anything to picture Kerry in a bad light, and then the other end of the spectrum is the corporate centrists who are always trying to position themselves somewhere between the two major parties, and that's truly a spectrum that's out of whack, and it allows right-wing to get a lot of hit pieces into the media, or at least into the media briefly enough to do damage, even if they're not true. And I think it's why Kerry will be at a disadvantage, just like Gore was at a disadvantage last time. I mean, you look back at the 2000 campaign, and you hear all this talk about the, quote, liberal media. As almost always, the Republican candidate Bush in 2000 got 61% of the endorsements from daily newspapers. Gore got 39%, and Ralph Nader got 1/3 of 1%. He got one small daily in Vermont. An editor and publisher does that poll every 4 years, and they also interviewed the editors and publishers of newspapers across the country right before the 2000 election, and the overwhelming majority of editors and publishers wanted Gore to win.
Wanted Gore or Bush?
I'm sorry, they wanted Bush to win. Thank you.
Yeah.
Right, so... So, when you hear this talk about the liberal media, but those who really have power, the editors, the top editors and the publishers, tend to be very, very conservative. And I learned from my experience at MSNBC, where I was a senior producer, that the biggest fear in a corporate centrist news outlet is of doing anything that could get you or your network accused of being liberal.
We're talking to Jeff Cohen today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Jeff Cohen is the founder and longtime executive director of FAIR. He most recently worked as communications director on the Kucinich for President campaign. He's also worked at CNN as a host at Times and Crossfire and as an executive producer for The Donahue Show. I want to talk about your experience at The Donahue Show in a second, Jeff, but mm-hmm. before we get to that, I want to remind our listeners that this is a taped show. Please don't try to call in. We taped it a few days before going on air. Just sit back and relax and enjoy it. There seems to be one other factor in the presidential race that I want to talk about before we move on, which is the role of these TV political ads, because it strikes me that what happens is a candidate with an enormous amount of money who can buy a lot of ads can almost set the agenda for what journalists write about as like the relevant issue to be covered. So if you do a series of attack ads on your opponent, then journalists make that the story of the week.
Right. Oh, no doubt. And I believe that, you know, you've got an assumption in the mainstream media, partly established, as you say, by TV ads, but partly established by the bias of the media, which is that George Bush is some sort of strong wizard on national security. And every news story, because of the ads and because of the bias, the news stories begin with, how is John Kerry going to impress the American people with his national security credentials? And that kind of discussion must strike a person from England or France or Germany or Mexico or Chile as complete insanity. That here's a world that's as unstable as ever, a president that's seen as having made foreign policy blunder after blunder, beginning with the inability of his government to protect the American people from the 9/11 attacks, when there was so much intelligence that might have allowed that to be prevented. But you have an assumption in mainstream coverage, and part of it is because of the way the media covered Bush from September 11th onward. There's this assumption, and it's all in the ads, where the Bush ads talk about this great war president, and you find Kerry's ads playing along with the bias. Kerry, I think, is trying to counterpunch by imitating the concept that you know, national security means how many troops you send to Iraq, as opposed to what national security should really mean, which is, are the American people and is the world more safe and stable than it was? And clearly it is not.
You know, John Kerry, on this point, I mean, when he was running for the Democratic nomination, he was a pretty strong anti-war candidate when he's out on the stump. He was
imitating Dean.
He was giving a pretty, what you would call a populist or right. progressive or liberal message. And once he sort of locked up the nomination and Edwards dropped from view, it seems like those messages have also disappeared.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the club in Washington that runs these political campaigns for the Democrats, the same people that ran the Gore campaign against a candidate, Bush, who was seen in many sectors as being sort of a joke, just not up to the job. And they were able to run that campaign so brilliantly that, you know, Bush got close enough to walk away with the election in Florida. And the people that did so, you know, I'm being sarcastic when I say brilliantly, those who ran the campaign of Gore are now working at Kerry, and they seem to bungle it every time. I mean, if you were a manager or an owner of a baseball team, would you hire and pay top dollar to a pitcher whose record is like 2 wins and 19 losses? And it seems like when it comes to the Democrats, you find these consultants, they make more and more money every 4 years, and they can't figure out how to win. And I think, Bob, you were right that the way to win is, since the American people are largely working class and middle class people, is with the populist message that talks about the unfairness in our tax code and our economic system. That's a winner. And you just you don't hear that. It seems like in Washington, the political consultants are so close to the corporate lawyers on K Street that they think it's more important to impress those 200 people than tens of millions of working class voters who could be won to the Democratic Party on a populist appeal. You're right, though, that during the presidential campaign, Kerry was very much chasing after Dean and Kucinich on some of these issues, and now you have him running against Bush. He seems to be chasing after Bush. I'm not sure that's a way to win an election.
Yep, we're talking to Jeff Cohn today on Media Matters. And Jeff, you served for a while on the Donahue Show as an executive producer, one of the founding executive producers, I think, when the show went on the air. And the Donahue Show is a sort of brief glimmer now that was on the air. And when it came about, when it went on the air in 2002?
Yes.
But it came on the air in sort of the midst of all the controversy of how conservative talk radio and cable television had become. There were really no liberal or progressive voices. And then MSNBC, to much fanfare, announced that it would have the first liberal talk show, hosted by noted liberal, Nader supporter, longtime liberal activist and progressive Phil Donahue, a figure with considerable public stature after decades of being a prominent talk show host. I mean, you were present at the creation and really there for much of the show. You know, the promise of the Donahue show was it was going to be this liberal progressive alternative that would really give people a choice. What happened?
Well, the show, as you say, Donahue was hired before the war was, before it was clear that the Iraq war was going to dominate the news cycle. And the announcement was made that Donahue was hired. I'm sure it was a discussion that had some dissenting voices at the top of NBC, but he's hired. Months go by before we ever go on the air for the first time, and lo and behold, the Iraq war, the impending war, is a dominant issue, and MSNBC realized, oh, heck, we've hired one of the strongest anti-war voices there is to host the show every night in primetime. So there was always this obsession at MSNBC with Donahue toward balance. The odd thing is we were up against O'Reilly at Fox News, who had never been cautioned by management to be balanced. And so from the beginning, there was an effort at on behalf of management to not let Phil be Phil. And our show was muzzled almost from the beginning and was misframed almost from the beginning. When I think about Roger Ailes, who's the head of Fox News, if he ever heard the kind of instructions that management was giving Donahue, which is don't be too angry, don't be too partisan, don't be too liberal, make sure you're balanced, Roger Ailes would laugh his ass off, because that's not instructions he ever gave O'Reilly. You can't conceive of Ailes ever telling O'Reilly, be less angry, be less confrontational, be less partisan. It would be insane. And in a medium like cable news, where Fox had shown the way, that very strong and passionate advocacy programming at night could work and could attract an audience, at MSNBC, which is owned by General Electric and Microsoft, there was never a sense of, well, let's have Phil Donahue counter-program against that and build up an audience. That's not anything we were ever allowed. So we began with the balance, imposition of this balance demand, which was silly. And then it led a few months later to worse than that. As the war got closer, we were ordered by management that every time we had one anti-war guest, we had to have two pro-war guests. Every time we had two guests from the left.
You were literally, MSNBC management said to you that for every anti-war, you had to have 2:1 ratio pro-war to anti-war.
Yeah, we had to have always one more from the right. If you had two guests from the left, you had to have 3 from the right. At one meeting of our show, a producer said, well, I'd like to book Michael Moore. And the bosses said, then you'd have to have 3 right-wingers for balance.
Oh, boy, that's a compliment to Moore.
Yeah. And, I used to fantasize booking Noam Chomsky on the show, but I realized that our studio couldn't accommodate the 338 right-wingers we would have needed for balance. So it was truly an amazing thing. And then Donahue ultimately, they constantly would put on us a right-wing frame where Phil Donahue, who'd been a voice for expanding the debate and expanding consciousness in a more liberal direction for decades and had done it with millions and millions of viewers, including people that didn't agree with him on a lot of the issues, but they understood that he would present a fair and interesting show and would challenge their assumptions. This guy who had that history was completely bound up by MSNBC, and by the end, when they imposed this 1-2, 2-3 game on us, they also were saying that the headlines of the show had to be aimed at a Fox News audience. So we constantly had shows like Women, Are They Getting Too Many Rights? we had one, If You're Anti-War, Do You Hate America? It was like that kind of theme. Mm. And it was like really silly. Now, by the end, the day after the show was canceled, a memo leaked out that said that Phil Donahue represents a difficult public face for NBC, that he seems to delight in booking guests that are anti-war, anti-Bush, skeptical of the administration's motives, unquote. Now, it was always my understanding of a free press that your job was to present skeptical guests and guests that would challenge the prevailing wisdom. But that was if you look at this internal memo that was never supposed to leak out, and thankfully it leaked out the day after Phil Donahue was canceled at MSNBC, and it's referring to him as a difficult public face. It goes on to describe a nightmare scenario for NBC, which is that, quote, Donahue would become a home for the liberal anti-war agenda at the same time that our competitors are waving the flag at every opportunity, unquote. And so if you watched MSNBC before the war or during the war, you'll realize no one waved the flag as vociferously at MSNBC. It's part of a strategy that many are doing in television news, which is let's try to outfox Fox. And it truly says something about the media that Phil Donahue, who'd been known for years as a guy who, while he had a strong point of view, was respectful of people that disagreed with him and respectful of other points of view, Phil Donahue was deemed a, quote, difficult public face for NBC, unquote. At the same time they fired Donahue, they hired Michael Savage, a guy who is a racist, inflammatory speaker. You know, says women should be denied the vote. His website suggested before the war that anti-war leaders be arrested. He referred to, you know, he talks about Latinos breed like rabbits. Just, he's got something very mean to say about every ethnic group in the country. Michael Savage gets hired by MSNBC at the same time that Phil Donahue is fired as a, quote, difficult public face for NBC. It says more about the myth of the liberal media than a dozen books could say.
We're talking to Jeff Cohn today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We taped the show a few days before going on, so please don't call in. Just sit back and listen and enjoy. By the way, if you would like to get a weekly email, which will give the upcoming guests on Media Matters for the coming show, plus links to their work and a catalog of back shows, you can get one by emailing our producer, Victor Picard, and you can do that by sending an email to vpicard, V-P-I-C-K-A-R-D, at uiuc.edu. We'll only send you one a week. We can get off the list anytime you want. We don't share the list. You won't get any junk mail or any spam from us. But a lot of people like this because then if they're interested in the books the people are talking about or the groups they work with, there'll be links they can click right on them, and they can get an alert to what's coming up on the show the coming week. By the way, 1 week from today we'll have as our guest Janine Garofalo, the comedian and the host now of the show on Majority Report, I think it's called?
Yeah, on the network Air America.
On Air America, that's right. So she'll be our guest 1 week from today. Jeff, you've been talking about what's been going on, what went on with Donahue in the war. And just last week, there was quite a controversy with one of the big television station-owning groups, Sinclair Broadcasting, refusing to carry on eight of its stations a program that would by Nightline that was actually simply going to give the names and pictures of the troops that have been killed in the Iraq War. And this seems to be cut from the same cloth as MSNBC's attitude towards Donahue.
Yes. I think that there's, and remember, when you're talking about Ted Koppel, you're not talking about an anti-war person. You're talking about someone who's close friends with the war-making establishment that has been for years. Henry Kissinger has been for years a close friend of Ted Koppel. So the fact that Ted Koppel is now doing something that is irritating to these owners and they're punishing over it, it really says something about the rightward and corporate drift of the media. And it's very scary. I think what we've learned, and Bob, you've written more about this than anyone, when you have corporate consolidation and all this opinion-shaping power in the hands of fewer and fewer big companies, it makes conformity and censorship quicker and easier. To me, the Sinclair Station Group taking Koppel off the air because of content they don't like, it's reminiscent of Clear Channel, where right after September 11th, they send out that list of songs that are deemed inappropriate because of, quote, questionable lyrics. And they're telling their stations not to air peace songs by John Lennon and Bruce Springsteen. Even an Ozzy Osbourne song was on that list. But my favorite on the list of songs that probably shouldn't be aired because of questionable lyrics, there's that reference in the Clear Channel list, All Rage Against the Machine songs. When you have so much power over content that can be exercised so whimsically by a few people, it's really scary. And it's just, conformity and censorship is made easier as we have fewer and fewer owners.
And I think the point with Sinclair, too, is that the executives for that company were major contributors, or are major contributors, to the Bush-Cheney reelection effort. And the Bush-Cheney administration has been pushing media relaxation of ownership rules that the Sinclair Group is a big advocate of.
Right. And I mean, look at Clear Channel. You're right. Sinclair is known for giving 98 to 100% of their donations to Republicans. Clear Channel is a company, ironically, that thrived because of deregulation brought about by Bill Clinton and his telecommunications deregulation bill of 1996. But it's a company that's very close to the Bush administration, and some of their stations were having these so-called pro-America rallies during the war, at which Dixie Chick CDs are bulldozed. That's not my idea of pro-America. So you're right. I mean, it's very scary. It's this nexus of corporate power and political power, and the big losers are the average ordinary viewer, listener, or reader of mass media. Sometimes they don't even know what strings are being pulled that are denying them certain information and certain points of view.
Well, Jeff Cohen, I mentioned that next week our guest on Media Matters is going to be Janine Garofalo. She has her show on the new liberal radio network Air America, which has gotten a lot of attention recently. We had Al Franken on the show before it went on the air a couple of months ago. Is this going to be the solution to the problem, getting Air America out there so there's an alternative voice? What's your take on Air America?
I'm not excited by the few number of stations that they're on. You really need to have some carriage for you to have impact. And it's sort of a chicken and egg. I mean, they've got a lot of obstacles in front of them. I think they've got basically an ownership structure in American radio headed by Clear Channel and also Viacom and Disney. Between Clear Channel, Viacom, and Disney, you have three companies that are just in the habit of shock jocks and monotone right-wing talk. They own hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of channels, those three. They bring us a lot of the programming. I think Air America's got major obstacles. I wish them luck, though.
Jeff, what about the Fox News channel? You were actually on there as a regular panelist on one of their shows for years. The Fox News channel has a reputation of being pro-Republican, pro-Bush. I mean, Vice President Cheney just recently called it his favorite news channel, the only one he thought that was really reliable and accurate. How could that be? Here we've heard you as a strong critic of the media from the left, as a strong critic of conservative media like Fox News Channel, yet they managed to find a place to give you a job for a couple of years.
It proves that for every rule, there's an exception. And I think I was one of the exceptions. The basic rule at Fox News is that most of the coverage and most of the guests, and by the way, go to fair.org, you'll find their survey of Brit Hume's guest list on Fox News. Most of the guests, most of the topics, most of the frames tilt to the right in Fox News. It's not debatable. I was one of their only paid pundits who was on the other side. It's just that simple. I had more freedom at Fox News than I ever did at MSNBC, which was ironic, because I think at Fox News they're confident enough that their right-wing point of view is being heard over and over and over on their channel that they can tolerate Jeff Cohen on the weekends. Whereas the corporate centrist, and I was making this point a little earlier, the corporate centrist outlets like MSNBC, which is owned by General Electric, a major military contractor, and MSNBC, there is an overriding fear. It's a fear of offending people in power. It's a fear of offending corporations. And as I said, the number one fear, and I found this in more than one place, the number one fear is doing anything that could get you or your network accused of being liberal. They're just constantly looking over their shoulder, worried about doing that. The right wing has done an amazing job at intimidating journalists, and now you have the ridiculous situation where a guy who's been for decades an interventionist and a pro-war voice like Ted Koppel, even he's not sufficiently hawkish for a particular media-owning company.
Well, what's striking about Koppel's chastise form, but Nightline's chastise for, is actually just honoring people who have died. It's
right.
It's not like they're giving voice to anti-war arguments.
Right. Imagine if they actually did the independent kind of reporting that you find in mainstream media in England, France, Germany, Canada, Mexico. Imagine Sinclair's owners going nuts if he was actually doing some solid journalism. Occasionally, Koppel does it, but it's very rare. The best show, you know, most of the television news, you have to understand, it's reality-based entertainment programming. That's what I've learned by being there. I mean, you know, when I talk about the fear of offending those in power, it's matched by a euphoria about covering stories that are absolutely meaningless about crime and celebrities and fluff and sex scandals. You know, the two things go hand in hand. This animated, almost, you get giddy over there when there's a new sex or celebrity story, and it's matched by this timidity of covering real news that might offend someone in power, especially economic or political power. So I just it's really something that a guy like Koppel is being punished.
Jeff,
and they aren't. You don't see this kind of coverage that is mainstream in so many other democratic countries.
Jeff, I remember back in the mid-90s, you were being auditioned as
right.
as the official liberal counterpoint on CNN's Crossfire, which at that time was really a very prominent show. It was before Fox,
right.
a sort of a center of
right.
Political debate in the country. As I recall, you were rejected primarily, or one of the reasons given, was that you were not sufficiently pro-Democratic Party?
We never got the full reasons. This was in 1995 and 96. Michael Kinsley had quit, and they did major tests, and I got in the finals. And I was getting rave reviews. And leaders of all sorts of mass constituencies from labor and feminism and members of Congress and Bill Moyers and Phil Donahue and Nader, they all said, yes, you finally located someone who would be a forceful and articulate advocate for our side. And the producers there thought I was great. Many of them didn't know me much. I'd been an occasional guest on that show, but they didn't know me as well as the others. And I got in the finals, rave reviews in some newspapers, and then Bill Press was hired. Now, the best write-up of this whole process is in Jim Hightower's book, you know, about the middle of the road.
Oh, yeah, there's nothing in the middle of the road but dead armadillos.
Right. He writes this up beautifully, but I'll make the long story short. Hightower and others said, well, the problem with Jeff Cohen is he thought that he could get a job on American TV representing the left, but you can't get such a job if you're actually on the left. And what that's a reference to is the history of television, way before Fox News, of setting up a center-right spectrum. The people that pioneered in that spectrum were CNN and PBS, where the right wing would be represented by an articulate, very forceful, telegenic advocate of conservatism, and the left would be represented often by a not very articulate, not very telegenic person that was barely left of center.
Well, that definitely would not describe you, Jeff.
No.
I'm afraid I have to say at this point we're running out of time here on Media Matters, so we're going to have to close it at that note. Jeff Cohen, founder of Fairness in Action Reporting and longtime executive director, thank you so much for being our guest today on Media Matters.
Thank you.
And please join us one week from today with Janine Garofalo. My name is Bob McChesney, and I want to thank Victor Picard, my wonderful producer. See you next week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, presenting Urbana Uncorked, a special wine tasting event to benefit WILL AM-FM-TV on Saturday, May 15th from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Urbana Civic Center. Dozens of wines will be featured along with a silent auction and music by the Baroque Artists of Champaign-Urbana. Tickets are available at the door or in advance at the Corkscrew. For more information, call 337-7704.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, partly sunny, breezy, and warm with a small chance of a shower or thunderstorm. The high in the mid-80s with southwest winds 15 to 25 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with the low in the lower 60s and southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a chance of showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon. The high in the lower 80s with southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. This is WILL Urbana, listener-supported public radio. It's 2 p.m. Central Time, a Prairie Home.